session number 18496, reel 3.
Peter Willoughby, reel 3. About when did you arrive at Tarrant Rushton?
It would be the end of February, possibly. Maybe the beginning of April.
1945. What did you find when you got there?
Well, we were two squadrons on the airfield, ourselves 298 and together with 644, who were doing the same operations. That was resupply for the SOE, the resistance people, and interim doing glider towing. We had a programme of training to do when we first got to the squadron, and I remember the CO saying he didn't want average crews, he wanted the best, and if we didn't come up to that, we'd go. And I guess we must have succeeded because we stayed on. Again, that was training exercises. There was quite a bit of flying. Again, now that's raised a point there. Anyway, a lot of intruder flying on the East Coast where we did operate first. So we transferred and did all our flying up on the West Coast, up into Scotland and back. Again, concentrated on navigation, container dropping, and glider towing with one or two rather big exercises on with the gliders. And
what was it like towing the glider?
Well, it did vary slightly between whether you were towing the hawser or the larger tank carrying Hamilcar, which the Hamilcar, of course, was as big as the Halifax anyway. You had a slower takeoff, a longer takeoff, should I say, and providing the glider lifted as soon as he sort of got sufficient speed, it was okay. If he tended to stay down, which I remember on one occasion one glider pilot did, we just couldn't get our tail up, and we almost ran out of runway. Had it not been for the fact that this particular runway, a Tarrant rushed and dropped into sort of a bit of hollow off the end, we might not have made it. But the Hamilcar, again, was pretty hefty lift, and you did feel a difference. You were taking a longer takeoff run, obviously because of the weight you were towing. Other than that, in the air, providing he kept his proper position and flew reasonably well, there was very little difference in it. The system, well, for a main sort of glider operation, there are photographs, I think you probably have some in the museum, of the glider lineup. The gliders were on the runway behind the other. The hawsers would be in front. The Hamilcars were at the back because they needed a longer run. And the aircraft were sort of parked on the grass alongside it with the tow rope connected. So you virtually just taxied out, turned and took off one after the other. That was rather about that side of it. Well, I say the normal glider towing practicing, we had a glider pilot regiment stationed with us, and we were doing that fairly daily, pretty well. Take them off to about 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet sometimes. Come round, glider would cast off, we would fly around and drop our tow rope in a designated area at the side of the airfield, and come back down and land in. I remember the call sign was Matchbox as far as the glider was concerned, and we were Playmate because we had an intercom link between the two. The system there for dropping was well, not on, on practice, obviously, but on an exercise or operation, was to, you call the glider about 5 minutes beforehand, before he got to the dropping zone, let him know that he was there. In fact, with a Hamilcar, I think that gave him the opportunity to start the engine of the tank so that when it got out, it was warm. And that was, I think that's all really there was about the glider towing side of it. The Hamilcar, as I say, was a pretty hefty piece of kit. The pilot sat up on the, well, I know he's been describing that all that's going to be available. I don't think there was anything really unusual really about that. Again, the security at the station was pretty tight from the secrecy angle. We would be carrying stuff which we would say, what are we carrying? And we were told, well, the SAS guys did the packing, they'll tell you. Well, they never did. The only reason you got idea of what you were carrying was in the type of container you actually carried. Because the container varied, whether it was fragile stuff, sort of radios and that kind of stuff, or blankets, clothing, that they were dropped very often in a pannier, a wicker pannier.
Were they SAS or SOE?
Well, I don't know why I said SOS. It could be SOE. No, that was Subversive Operations Europe, wasn't it?
Special Operations
Europe. Executive. Could have been. Now, maybe I'm mistaken on that one. But I know the security was pretty tight. And it amazed me, actually, how quickly we got a report back from the field as to what they had received, that they'd received the goods. And it was amazing if they said they hadn't got what you delivered, you were up on the carpet to find out where they'd gone. How you could have had any idea of that, I wouldn't know, because the system was, when you dropped, I did the actual drop, and I could check from my bomb panel that everything had gone off. Then rear gunner counted the chutes and packages going out. And also, as the navigator had nothing to do at that time, and the engineer, in the Halifax, there was a series of sort of like manholes, if you like, in the fuselage, over the bomb points. And they had those removed and checked that we had no hang-ups. So if everything left us where the other one went to, any that were lost, I don't know.
Were you ever carpeted yourself?
No.
And what was your actual job in the aircraft on the container dropping?
My responsibility, as we went out, we would fly at about 3,000 feet over UK, got to the coast, and we'd go down to 500 feet, fly in over Holland there to a rendezvous point, which was generally an easily identified feature on the ground. Now, the navigator was responsible for getting us there to within a set time. From there to the actual dropping zone, my job then was to map read in, purely and simply from ground features, and at the same time adjust any difference in time to virtually arrive at the dropping zone at a specific time within 30 seconds or so, I think it was they stipulated, but whether we tried to do our best to get there within that time, because obviously the resistance chaps on the ground didn't want to spend much more time than necessary in the open. And on that flight, that trip in, which varied in length, I had to sort of tell the skipper to either slow down or increase speed to try and adjust the time. And then when you got to the dropping zone, they had, or were supposed to have, lights out in the form of a T, which was near as possible into wind. So you were dropping up the T into wind. And also they had a code which they would flash. And unless you got that, you didn't drop. And sometime when you got there, the lights would be on. Occasionally they weren't on. And I recall, I think it's the first trip, they weren't on. And of course, Skip accused me of not getting to the right place. Oh, I said, do a circuit. And as we circled, the lights came on. And ran in and did the drop. And as I say, that being the first trip, we stuck our nose down and came out as quick as we could. Much lower than 500 feet. But that was the general setup. You found the area, it was marked with a T into wind, and the idea of dropping into wind, of course, was you had more control over your parachutes, your containers. And the call sign that they would flash had to be definitely identified, because the Germans did set up dummy DZs at times. I don't know how successful they were, but we were told that they did do that. And that was really the type of the operation that we did, actually. Came back and didn't, it wasn't a very long one. The long, which I didn't go on, actually, Norwegian, we did runs up into Norway. Oh, sorry. There, it was a different kettle of fish, because you had to go so much higher to get into Norway. And a lot of the resistance people were up in the mountains, which must have made it very, very difficult for our guys to find the places, really. But there again, we had a bit of radio and other work. I can't remember the name of the thing. Eureka and something like that. Well, they had a transmitter and you could actually home in onto that. That was used in Norway because of the difficulty in the terrain.
But did you not go on
a Norwegian? I didn't do a Norwegian trip. Not as such, not till VE Day, Operation Doomsday. That was VE Day plus two. We flew the airborne div into Norway as, I suppose, as a form of army of occupation, I guess. I don't know. Our CO went over there probably on VE Day. He would probably go, or at least VE Day plus one at the latest, to sort of command the operation. And our various squadrons within 38 Group were flying in stores, actually carrying a jeep on one occasion, which that was another little point we did. They did do some testing on dropping jeeps and 25-pounder guns slung under the aircraft, which wasn't very successful on the guns and not very good on the jeeps either. But that was the idea. Anyway, that faded out before the end of the war. They didn't use that. But we did about, I think it was four trips to Norway on this Operation Doomsday.
To Bergen?
Gardermoen. Airfield of Gardermoen, which was north of Oslo. Sort of, if I recall, it was sort of straight up the fjord and over Oslo, and Gardermoen was just beyond it. That was quite interesting going in there, because the amount of German Luftwaffe aircraft were there were unbelievable. Had everything you could think of, almost. And from the air, their camouflage was excellent. It wasn't until you got down on the ground you realised how many aircraft they had there.
But the actual container dropping operations, you said, were to the Netherlands?
Yes, that's the only place I did any. But they had been over the whole of occupied Europe over the period during the war. I mean, the operations over in France with the Machi and that had been pretty well documented, I think. And as the war moved on, so we moved up. I think we did some in Denmark as well. Funnily enough, I don't know, it was after the war. Well, it obviously was after hostilities ceased. my parents received a parcel from Denmark of butter and similar sort of things. Sort of a way of saying thank you for what I presumably had done during the war, which I'd never been there. So where they got my name from, I don't know. But that was a little sort of aside to it.
But were you dropping arms to the resistance, or were you dropping food to civilians?
No, to the resistance. We didn't. The food to the civilians, I think, were handled by Bomb Command. I think they did a lot of that. But we didn't. Not in our squadron, anyway. Whether any of our other units did, I don't know, but we didn't.
How many drops to the resistance do you think you might have done?
Personally, I think I needed two, actually.
Both to Holland?
Yeah. And then in the interim period after VE Day, as I say, we did the four trips to Norway. We actually dropped containers there to get a little bit more sort of, I don't know what they were either, stores, food or something like that anyway. And then we picked up a crowd of ex-POWs from Belgium. We only did one trip on that one too, which had to spend a night in Brussels, because as we were ready for takeoff, we'd flown through a thunderstorm going, and just we were on the point of takeoff, the thunderstorm caught up with us, and we got to the end of the runway and they recalled us, by which time our brakes had gone, so we had to stay overnight till they flew out some new tyres for us. I've still got a little slip of paper which says that the pilot officer will be a distressed air crew and has permission to be in Brussels with the date. From then, as I say, that was after the war, after hostilities ceased in Europe, we were then told that we were going out to the Far East to take part in the retaking of Singapore, which I think was codenamed Operation Zipper. And we were re-equipped with new aircraft. I then flew out. I can't remember the date of that now.
You mean New Halifax?
Yeah, New Halifax. With a container under which fitted under the bomb bay. Up to then we'd been flying just the normal bomb bay, but now they fitted a container which fitted over the bomb bay for carrying stores. And that was a new adaptation of the aircraft then. And we flew out there via Castel Bonito, Lida, Shaiba in Iraq, and into Karachi. From there, staged from there on to central India to where we're going to be stationed, at a place called Raipur, which was in central provinces. I didn't get out there straight away. I unfortunately went straight to the hospital when we arrived at Karachi, and then joined the squadron after about a fortnight, I think.
You went as a patient to hospital?
Yeah, I got heat exhaustion. And I'm sort of straight off the aircraft, straight in the hospital. And another one of our crew, no, actually a passenger we were carrying, he came in with me as well. He was in the same state. Oh, and a second pilot, I think he came too. It was a pretty rough going, that trip out there. And at Raipur, we were due again. They were building up an airborne division in India, ready for the operation. We only had the American Wacko gliders on our station, which was rather bright, because we couldn't tow a Wacko. It wasn't glider wasn't strong enough to withstand the pull of the Halifax, unfortunately. Then, what were we doing there, really? Not a great deal. We were flying stuff into a place further north called Billesburg, where the airborne division was sort of centred. And we were there, of course, when at the end of in August when the war eventually ended. Then what do we do after that? Well, nothing. We were doing on what we call scheduled runs, so the transport runs backwards and forwards across India on the set route, until they decided that air gunners and air bombers, well, I was classified actually possibly a nav bomber, because I was an air bomber navigation rather than straight the air bomber. I didn't drop any bombs in anger anyway. they decided that they were surplus to requirements under the new idea, and I was posted to three of us, well, quite about, I don't know how many it would be, NCOs, three of officers and number of NCOs, posted to 52 Squadron at Dum Dum, where I was in, worked in the, employed in the detail office there. And so really, we were destined to be stewards, but we didn't fancy that idea. And fortunately, the CO of 52 Squadron said, "No way, you're not going to work as stewards," because they were on transport command completely. They were doing set runs down to, well, all round India and down into Burma as well. Then I was there for a while, and applied for a posting to headquarters at Vafsi headquarters at Delhi. I went up for an interview there, and whilst there, I called in at another section to see a friend who I knew was there, and his CO popped in and sort of intimated that they were short of staff, and I said, "Well, I'm looking for a job. How about it?" He said, "Right." He said, "We'll organise the posting." I'm afraid I pestered the adjutant a little while after that to find out when the posting came through. I was going down to the office one morning, and he leaned out the window and called me. He said, "Your posting's through." I said, "Oh, good." "To Delhi?" "No," he said, "back to the squadron." I said, "Oh, dear." I said, "What about the Delhi one?" He said, "That's come through as well." Well, I said, "Can't you forget the squadron one?" He said, "No, the CO's seen it. You've had it. Flying takes preference." So I was then rejoined the squadron, who by that time were at in Bengal, at a place called Digri. And there we were sort of working up again to be, well, so get back into the state we had been before they'd kicked us out of the squadron, sort of thing, doing training runs, training flights, and I had to do a lot of screening of the other crews. And a job cropped up. The natives in the north of Burma had been told not to grow rice, or to reduce the rice crops, because of the Japanese occupation. And by the time it got to the end of the war, they were getting to a sad state from the food angle. So they tried supplying them by road, but it was pretty inaccessible. I think a jeep, and a brand new jeep and a trailer, lasted about four trips. And it was getting close to the monsoon season, when the whole lot would have had to close down. So they decided that we'd try and do airdrops. So we were a guinea pig crew. We did a trip, we went into Burma, and we did a trip, I think it was just about over the border, into Thailand. Well, no, it wasn't Thailand, then it was Siam. And did a trial drop there, and did a few trips up into the northern air. There's three airfields in North Burma around a town called Michinaw. You won't be able to spell that.
Yes, I am.
You know it. And the Americans have been using them for the hump run. They'd now deserted them. And we were going to use one of those as a staging point. So they sent a detachment of our squadron, about 10 aircraft, I think it was, to into Burma, to Mike Tiller. And there we were joined by 10 Squadron, who was ex-bomber command, who they'd been taken off Halifax's and put onto Dakotas. Told they couldn't take the Halifax's out east, and of course the first thing they saw when they got there was our Halifax's, which made quite a bit of difference. They didn't like us very much. There were a lot of jealousy. But anyway, that's beside the point. The Dakotas couldn't do a round trip to Michinaw and back. So their system was, they would go out in the morning fully loaded with most of it rice and a certain amount of salt. We would then go out with a load in the fuselage and another in the container in the bombay container, go up to the dropping zones, which were in the northern hills north of Michinaw, drop the fuselage load through. We had a parachute hole in the back of the aircraft. Drop that, come back to Michinaw, land, unload the load from the pannier, and that kept the Dakota. They could do the short runs then from Michinaw. And we did that till, that would be the April. We finished it in March and into April of 45.
46,
sorry, yes. That was going on. And that worked pretty well. We got to, it was pretty hairy actually in there, because we were in right in the mountains. We're going into the valleys, and it was a bit of hairy flying. In fact, I think traffic control in UK would have gone bananas if they'd seen the condition we were flying under, because we had to come in very, very low. And one particular dropping zone was very difficult. We had to come over this ridge. You couldn't see the dropping zone. It came out down the valley, over the ridge. And as soon as you got over the ridge, you had to shut everything off, drop wheels, flaps and everything to get your speed down and lose the height, do the drop on this village, and then pick everything up, put everything on, and climb over the next ridge. It just got pretty hairy. And the only other incident that really happened there was 10 Squadron lost three of their Dakotas in one morning. We were up on that trip, and they said, when we're up there, after we'd landed, then would we go up and make a search, see if we could find them? Well, we didn't. We didn't find them. There was one valley which was running about due east up towards, the Chinese border was only about 20 miles away, actually, and the mountains there went up to 16,000 feet, I believe it was, something like that, very, very high. Anyway, this particular valley, the skipper said about looking up there, and I said, no, we're not going up there, we can't get out, it narrows, and we couldn't get out. And apparently that's where the three of them had gone in. And unfortunately, well, there was only one survivor, and he was an Indian Army dispatcher they used for throwing out the rice sacks. And he was the only one that survived. And we didn't know that for quite a long time, till he came down through the local natives that brought him in. Then one of our aircraft put down at Michinaw on three engines. And at the end of the completion of the operation, our crew went up to Michinaw with two or three of the ground staff to do an engine change on this particular aircraft, so they wouldn't allow us to fly it out on three. It could have been done, but nobody would authorise it. You couldn't do it.